My family moved when I was in the seventh grade from a town that was pretty large and to a village, really, of only about 2,000 in population. In that little town, just about everyone in the school that I went to had grown up together from birth and been together since kindergarten and school. It was a town that didn't have a high school, so the school went from kindergarten through the eighth grade. And the arrangement was that when it was time to go to high school, you could go to some neighboring district, and our little town would then pay the tuition as an out-of-district student. I was 13 years old in the seventh grade and a newcomer, and it was hard. It's just difficult to be the new kid at school. But I had some excellent teachers who were caring and helpful and were really quite excellent. One of them was Mr. G. He was my language arts teacher. He encouraged me. He encouraged me to write and to read, and he believed in me, and he made a difference in my life, a difference for good. Although I attended that school for less than 2 years, it was kind of a sad day when it came to graduation from the eighth grade and leaving it all behind. The next 2 years, I attended a high school in the neighboring town. And then four towns, including the village from which I came, went together to establish a new regional high school. And amazingly, the principal of that school hired Mr. G again to be in a new district and to be my English teacher. It was at West Essex High School, and he was my friend. I was the class president. He was the faculty advisor. When I graduated from high school and came back at Christmas time, I went with a high school friend who had also gone off to college back to West Essex High School to go and visit Mr. G and find out how things were going and to be further encouraged by him. And some years later, when Charlene and I were married, we sent an invitation to my mentor and friend, and he gave to us, I think, an expensive silver gift that we still have and still value today. So Mr. G was my mentor, he was my teacher, he was my friend. But the story doesn't end well. He became the faculty advisor of other classes. He helped them raise money and edit the yearbook and plan the junior-senior prom and all of the things that a faculty advisor does. But then one day I heard the news that Mr. G had embezzled money from the school and from the student treasury, that he was publicly humiliated, that he was fired from his job, that he was excluded from ever teaching in the state again. Maybe you've had someone that you've looked up to, and this has happened. It's someone you've admired, someone you've loved. You've been deeply disappointed. It may have been a teacher who abused authority, or perhaps a pastor that preached morality but behaved immorally, or maybe a trusted financial advisor who ripped you off and you lost money because of what was done. Or maybe a parent whom you love with all of your heart and you were betrayed. Or perhaps a politician whose policies you believed in and you gave money and you campaigned for him and you voted for him, only to discover that when elected into office, he was deeply corrupt. So how do you react to all of this? What do you do with it? There are some of us who become cynics, where the hurt that is left behind becomes a wound that is never allowed to heal. Maybe you are counted among those who somehow decide intuitively or deliberately never again to trust any person who is a leader or is in authority, never to really trust any teacher or pastor or financial advisor or parent or politician. If you haven't been there, that's very good news, but the odds are that someday it's a place that you will go and experience. So we are in the midst of the biography of Israel's King David. His story is recorded in the Old Testament books of 1 and 2 Samuel. Those books get their name from the great prophet of the time, whose own biography is weaved into the beginning of this story, and who dominated much of the era. But Samuel dies, and it becomes almost exclusively the biography of David, Israel's great leader. Although in the last chapter of 1 Samuel, David is never mentioned. His name does not appear, even though it reports the happening of one of the most significant days in David's entire life. Years before, the people of Israel had been continually plagued by assaults and domination of the neighbor nation of Philistia. The people of Israel petitioned God. They did it directly through Samuel. They prayed and they petitioned that God would not only deliver them from the Philistines, but specifically that God would do it through a king. They wanted to be like the other nations, who had a king who would stand up for them and organize them and defend them against foreign assaults. But it turns out that God was offended by their request, because God said that he was their king, and he was their defender and their protector. But God answered their prayers as they requested, even though he was hurt by what they asked. And then he commissioned Samuel, his prophet, to search the nation to find the very best man to become the king of Israel. For the search, he looked across the 12 tribes of the nation, narrowed it down to the tribe of Benjamin, and then within the tribe of Benjamin to the family of Kish, and finally to a young man named Saul. He was perfect for the job. He was everything that you would expect a king to be. He was smart and articulate, and he was tall, and he was handsome, and he was godly, and he was humble. And he didn't seek the office. In fact, on his coronation day, he hid away because he was so overwhelmed by the task that was set before him. The Spirit of God filled King Saul and empowered him, gave him wisdom and skill to lead the nation of God's people. And it was a marvelous beginning. He was a brave soldier and he was a competent leader in the most difficult of times. And as a result, the nation loved him and everyone admired him, his royal majesty, King Saul. David would never forget the day when he first saw the king. He had been sent by his father to take supplies to his older brothers who were in the army of Israel, camped out on the eve of a great battle against that neighbor nation of Philistia. When David arrived, it was a giant named Goliath who was shouting out profanities against Israel's God. And David was stunned that no one would step up to take on the champion with the power of God. So he volunteered, and his brothers laughed out loud. They just mocked him. He was just more than a boy, barely a young man, and he's going to take on a veteran soldier who is a giant? It was silly. But Saul, the king, believed in him. Saul was convinced that David could do it. He had confidence that David could actually be the champion for God's nation of Israel. And from that day on, Saul became David's mentor and sponsor. He invited David into the royal court. He had him become among his chief musicians. He wrote poetry and he wrote tunes, and he was commissioned as a high officer in Israel's army. And David and Saul spent countless hours together, and Saul gave his daughter in marriage to David. It was the closest of relationships. And so David was fiercely loyal to this man whom he admired and whom he loved, his king and his father-in-law. He believed in him. And he became best of friends with the king's son, Prince Jonathan. And then Saul began behaving badly. He made terrible judgments. He spiraled in his relationship away from God. But David still believed in him. David still looked up to him. Even when King Saul so turned against David that he put a price on his head, and even when he personally tried to kill David, David's love and loyalty for his mentor and friend did not waver. He was still fiercely convinced that Saul was the right person, God's choice, to be the king of Israel. And he would not compromise either his loyalty to his king or his friendship with the king's son, Prince Jonathan. And then one day, there came a dreaded, decisive battle between the armies of Israel and Philistia. The two armies swept across the valley of Jezreel. The outcome was already predicted by God's prophet Samuel, that it would be a day of slaughter, terrible defeat for Israel. But even if you had not heard Samuel's prophecy, and even if you did not believe that God could predict what would happen, you could predict it yourself because it was an uneven match. The army of Philistia was larger and stronger and had an enormous strategic advantage with ranks of chariots that Israel could not match. As the army of Israel was being slaughtered, they ran to the slopes of Mount Gilboa. And somehow, perhaps in their retreat, they hoped that if they could get onto higher ground where the chariots could not operate, maybe then they could get a foothold. Maybe then they could fight back. But the Philistines, they were relentless and they were ruthless. And they targeted the king and his family, figuring that they could take down the command of the Israelite army, but they could also eliminate Israel's royal family. And they succeeded. And that day in that battle on the slopes of Mount Gilboa, the king's three sons were slaughtered. And King Saul himself was mortally wounded. It's all in 1 Samuel 31. Now the Philistines fought against Israel. The Israelites fled before them, and many fell slain on Mount Gilboa. The Philistines pressed hard after Saul and his sons, and they killed his sons Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua. The fighting grew fierce around Saul, and when the archers overtook him, they wounded him critically. Jonathan was David's best friend. The relationship is so classic that it is lifted up as the highest model of two men having the best of friend relationship. It's an awful day when your best friend dies, when you lose someone who understood you and whom you understood. And so for David, this was one of life's truly awful days. When someone you love dies and you're not present, there is a natural curiosity about the details of what happened. I think many of us do that. We ask the time on the clock. We ask every word spoken, every medical help offered. I think that at least in part, it makes us feel as if we were there. We wish we were there, but couldn't be there for some reason. And so we ask about all these details, although sometimes these are details that are left unknown. What happened was that Saul said to his armor bearer, "Draw your sword and run me through, or these uncircumcised fellows will come and run me through and abuse me." But his armor bearer was terrified and would not do it. So Saul took his own sword and fell on it. When the armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he too fell on his sword and died with him. So Saul and his three sons and his armor bearer and all his men died together that same day. It is a sad and a gruesome scene that the Bible here reports. Sort of makes me want to look the other way, to lift my eyes and thoughts off of the biblical page, because is more information than we need to know. These men took their own lives. Two of them did. Suicide is tragic. It's tragic regardless of the circumstances. And it breaks our hearts when anyone ever feels so desperate as to take one's own life. Although the deaths, the suicides of Saul and his armor bearer were linked, and although they happened on the same day and the same place, they were actually quite different. Saul knew the Philistines well. He knew that they were capable of unspeakable torture and atrocities, and he didn't want to fall into their hands. And so, mortally wounded, he decided it was better to die sooner rather than later. And if there was any dignity to be gained or to be held onto, that he could do this by dying before the Philistine soldiers would get to him and do whatever he feared they would do. And so he decided to determine himself the time of his death, and he asked for help. He asked for assistance in his suicide. But his armor bearer, loyal to him, wouldn't do it. He just couldn't bring himself to take the life of the king. And when the king took his own life, the armor bearer decided to do the same. And so he too fell on his sword. But his situation was very different. He wasn't wounded. He wasn't dying. He was just desperate. And in the horror of the moment, he could not imagine that there was any other possible alternative. He couldn't see any good thing that could happen into the future. And I kind of want to reach back through history and tap him on the shoulder and say, wait a minute, there's hope. You don't have to do this. I try to imagine an alternate ending to the story. I try to think that, yes, if he had not done this, perhaps, probably, he would have been captured by the Philistines, and perhaps they would have hurt him, and perhaps they would have taken him as a prisoner of war. But then there would have been an exchange of prisoners, or he might have escaped, or he could have lived until the better days came for Israel, and it wasn't too many calendar pages ahead that Israel became dominant and overcame the Philistines, and his life, he could have had life. It could have gone on, but he was caught up in the desperation of that moment. So there's a great contrast. Saul took his life because he was dying, but the armor bearer took his life because he was desperate. For the people of Israel, and especially for David, the grief was compounded by what next happened. When the Israelites along the valley and those across the Jordan saw that the Israelite army had fled and that Saul and his sons had died, they abandoned their towns and fled. And the Philistines came and occupied them. The next day, when the Philistines came to strip the dead, they found Saul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. They cut off his head and stripped off his armor. And they sent messengers throughout the land of the Philistines to proclaim the news in the temple of their idols and among their people. They put his armor in the temple of the Ashtoreths and fastened his body to the wall of Bethshan. The Israelites fled in terror. They walked away from their homes and their farms and their livestock. They left with only the clothes on their back and ran as far and as fast as they could. Can you imagine what that was like? We don't much imagine that. We quickly forget that there are millions of people around the world right now in our own generation who have been forced to flee their homes because of the terrors of war or of genocide. But we are so far from that and so protected that it's kind of unimaginable to most of us that we could ever be in a circumstance where some foreign invader would chase us away from everything that we cherish and everything that we own. But that's exactly what happened. Until these people of Israel became homeless refugees. And then the Philistines gloated in their victory. Saul's worst fears about the atrocities to be committed by the Philistines were absolutely true. They decapitated the dead king. They stripped off his armor. They took his body and they put it on the wall of a fortress at Beth Shan. That is a fortress considered to be impregnable at the meeting place of the Valley of Jordan and the Valley of Jezreel. It was on a commercial route. It was a place where people would go by and everyone would see it. It would be equivalent today to doing something like this with a billboard or a Capitol building. It was the most public of humiliations. And then they took his armor and they set it up in the temple of their goddess. And there was a not too subtle message here communicated that the goddess of Philistia was greater and stronger than Yahweh, the God of Israel. It was a dark and awful day. Can you feel David's agony? David's agony over all that happened. You know that he had to have thought, I should have been there. That's often the thought of those of us who are not there to help when someone we love is desperate and dying. David must have thought, if I had been there, I could have fought off those Philistines. If I had been there with my 600 men, this wouldn't have happened. If only I had been there, then my king would have survived all of this and escaped this humiliation. And so for David, it was this awful day. The pain of humiliation stacked on top of grief. It's hard to imagine any kind of good ending out of this terrible tale. But that is exactly what the Bible records. It is a report at the end of the book of 1 Samuel that most readers of the Bible would quickly read and soon forget. The kind of story, my guess is, that if you read it and I asked you 24 hours later about the specifics, you would barely recall what you had read. But I remember it, and I remember it well. When I was a little boy growing up, my mother often, I saw, reading the Bible. And she was, I think it is safe to say, a prolific Bible reader. And she would often bring quotes from what she read into everyday conversation. And she would make allusions to things in the Bible that I assure you were among the most obscure things that the Bible has to say. And honestly, I was going to say half the time, probably 98% of the time, I had no idea what she was talking about at all, just none. And I soon learned growing up to just smile, kind of pretend and sort of let it go. And she would do it at the kitchen table, and she would do it when I was going off to school, and she would use these Hebrew names, and who knows what it meant, including a nickname that she gave to me from her Bible reading. It is a nickname that only my mother has ever called me, and I would like to keep that record intact. So please don't ever, ever call me by this name because I want it to be the name that she only has called me. For when I was a little boy, she would call me Jabesh. She had read it in the Old Testament book of 1 Samuel, in the last paragraph, that when the people of Jabesh Gilead heard of what the Philistines had done to Saul, all their valiant men journeyed through the night to Beth Shan. They took down the bodies of Saul and his sons from the wall of Beth Shan and went to Jabesh, where they burned them. Then they took their bones and buried them under a tamarisk tree at Jabesh, and they fasted 7 days. Jabesh Gilead was sort of a border town. It was actually pretty far from most of the towns and the populations of Israel. But years before this, Jabesh Gilead had been under siege by the Philistines. And early in the reign of King Saul, he had marched the distance and saved the town. He had rescued them from this Philistine assault. And they never forgot. The Bible says that the men of Jabesh were valiant. And they did something that some, I suppose, would be critics and say is foolhardy. Against formidable odds, they attacked a fortress that was considered to be impregnable, and they retrieved the bodies of Saul and his sons. And they brought them back to Jabesh, and they buried them with the largest amount of honor that they could come up with under the circumstances. And then they fasted and mourned for 7 days over the death of their leader. In other words, the men of Jabesh did what was right, even when it was a very dangerous thing to do. Even when there are some who would say these men were already dead, and why bother? Why do this then? But it was the right thing, they thought. It was the right thing to honor the very best of a fallen leader and his sons. And although I didn't much appreciate or understand being called the nickname that my mother gave me, I have concluded it is an honor to be called Jabesh. So how do we relate to those to whom we have given our love and our loyalty, and they have failed us, deeply disappointed us, betrayed us? The Bible gives us a deep insight and a great precedent in the valiant men of Jabesh, a precedent that was followed later by King David himself. And that is that they chose to remember the best and give honor to a man whom others would say didn't deserve it. Perhaps you remember the line that Shakespeare wrote and put into the mouth of Mark Antony when, in his play Julius Caesar, Mark Antony was giving his eulogy after Caesar's assassination. And Mark Antony said, "The evil that men do lives after them, but the good is often interred with their bones." The men of Jabesh said, "That will not be the case with King Saul. We will not forget the good that he has done. Yes, he has failed, and yes, he has done things that a king ought never do, but they remembered his heroism. They remembered when he was filled with the Spirit of God, and they celebrated him, and they honored him. So when our heroes fall, let us grieve their loss. When our mentors sin, of course we should disclaim the evil. But the good they did is no less good, and the truth they spoke is no less true, and the love they gave is no less love. To remember well and honor fallen heroes does not condone the wrong they have done, but it simply celebrates what was good. And so, may we all be called Jabesh. God, we grieve when those whom we love and admire and to whom we have given our loyalty sin and fall. But may we be counted like the valiant men of Jabesh Gilead, among those who recognize truth and love and good, and honor the gifts that you give through leaders that have blessed us, even when they have not lived to the standard that we would choose. Help us, Lord. Bless us, we pray, as we bless the best in others. In Jesus' name, amen.